Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Kusha Navidar. It was August of 2020 when author Amy Lin lost her young husband, Curtis, just months before the two of them were planning to move to Vancouver. Amy was just 31 years old, and suddenly she had to face the experience of being a young widow. She's written a moving memoir about her experience grieving the loss of her husband and facing life as a widow. The book is called Hereafter, and she joined me recently as part of our ongoing series, Mental Health Mondays. We also took your very thoughtful calls as part of the conversation, but since this is an encore broadcast, we actually can't take your calls live today. I started by asking Amy about her late husband, Curtis, and how they first met.
Thank you. I'm so glad we're starting with Curtis, who's really the lodestar of this book. He and I were set up on a blind date by a woman who was my neighbor when I was a child. We lived side by side, making plant potions together until we were about 10, and then we lost total touch because she moved. And as is the kind of nature of childhood relationships, people move and they've immediately, you know, fallen off the planet. And when I was in my early 20s, 24, I ran into her on the street. And it had been decades. And she said, oh my gosh, let's grab coffee. And so we did. It was one of those rare things. We both had the time. And about 10 minutes in, she said, my boyfriend's roommate is perfect for you. Hmm. And that was Curtis.
What was he like? What were some of his goals and aspirations in life?
When I first met Curtis, one of his main goals was he wanted to grow his hair down to his shoulders. He had this gorgeous head of hair that he loved and that I truthfully think thrived and was grown longer on sort of words of affirmation. The more people comment on it, the longer it got. He was also in the very early years of his practice of architecture, and one of his deep passions, which we spoke at great length about, he actually took me to a building on our first blind date, was the ways in which the physical architecture of space can actually prepare us to hold better the emotional realities of space, which is not something I had ever thought about until I met Curtis. He really turned me towards the brick and mortar world and the ways in which it creates emotional space for us in a way that I just had never seen it before.
And you talk about emotional space and that creating emotional space, navigating through it, you know, that is a segue to talking about when you were married and when he unfortunately passed. How long was that time period between those two events?
So Curtis and I were together all in all, sort of just shy of 7 years, mm-hmm. married a year and a little bit is how I put it. We had very little time in some ways together, and other ways we had a kind of time together that feels so vast when I think about it. And when I think about how lucky I was to love someone like Curtis and to be held by him. And in so many ways, that period of time has completely radicalized and changed my life. And I think it's really shown me, we tend to, I think sometimes in grief, have different ideas of how much pain a one-year relationship that ends might have, or a 55-year relationship that ends, how much that might have. But the reality is, time doesn't exist in the landscape of grief. And the love that is grown, regardless of the time between two people, will always result in this infinite country of grief and of loss. And I'm really grateful for the time I had with Curtis. I wish there had been more, but there was so much love, an infinite amount of it.
That idea of grief and the experience, regardless of how much time you had, it, both of those things kind of being timeless, if that's a fair way to summarize it. Would you say you understood that before the event? Is that something you learned as a result of it? Were there other things that you learned about grief that you didn't expect through this process?
That's a beautiful question. I think until I was in it, I had no idea how much we are asked to hold as human beings, how much pain we are expected to be capable of holding. And I also didn't fully comprehend until I was in grief and continue to be in it, that really grief is the final form of love. It's actually what all of us will do if we love somebody. We will eventually carry them in grief and love them in grief. And I think when we societally try to like cheer people up when they're in grief, we want them to feel better. That's so human. But it means that we limit their ability to love the beloved who has gone. When we limit people's ability to speak about or show or even tell you about their grief and their pain, we limit their love in some way. We limit our ability to love in this way. And that wasn't something I understood till I was in it, that grief is painful and awful, but it is a part of the beautiful burden that we all bear of loving those of us that have died.
That's beautifully said. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Amy Lin, who's a writer and teacher. Her memoir, Hereafter, a memoir, was published on March 5th. We're talking about the loss that we experience when we become a widow or a widower and when we lose somebody important in our lives. And Amy, we got a text from a listener right now that I'd love to read asking for some advice. The text reads, "My best friend lost her husband very suddenly, leaving her and their 9-year-old son. What advice can Amy give to a friend on how best to support someone managing such grief?"
Wow, I really appreciate this question. So it's such a beautiful question to say, how can I help my friend in grief? And I'm so grateful for it. My advice always is sort of two things. The first would be, there's such a human urge to want to help in a really tangible way. So the obvious things of providing food, especially if you have a 9-year-old, so kid-friendly food, to help relieve the daily burden of what the grievers will have to process, and that's the child and the partner. But also, I encourage people who are supporting people in grief to witness their friends or their loved ones' pain. So instead of offering them things that might help them feel better, or we think we want to offer it to them, offer them recognition. Things like, "I bet you're not sleeping well. You must be exhausted. You must feel like you're the only person in this much pain. You must be so sad." These were things offered to me really early in grief that made me feel so grateful, because it allowed me a place to actually say the things that were happening to me. I was exhausted. I was tired. I was having difficulty keeping things straight. And when people allowed me a space to share that with them, they actually entered into my experience with me, and they made me less alone. And I think grief tries really hard to convince us that we're alone, that we're the only people in this kind of pain, and that other people don't want to know or don't know. And by offering grievers witness, I think we offer the best thing any of us can offer anyone, which is a place to be as you are.
Other tools that you've discussed for dealing with grief, you know, there's one part in the book where somebody you're talking to talks about the tools that you have, and everybody has specific tools for you. Yeah. That tool was writing. And you've talked about how people often ask you whether writing was a cathartic experience for you. And I'm using cathartic specifically here, because you said it's like asking someone who's drowning and receiving a flotation device whether they thought grabbing the rubber ring was cathartic. And so instead, I'm going to ask you, how did writing about the loss of Curtis keep you afloat and help you process what happened?
Thank you. That's a so thoughtfully put question. Writing for me is what I have, and we have different things. One person's grief is simply one person's grief. My friend Rebecca, who's in the book, grieves symbolically. So she does rituals around her grief, which is beautiful, and she doesn't write. For writing for me allowed me to create a place, a physical landscape in the vast territory of grief where I could put some of my pain, and where I could draw people to that spot and say, this is what it's like for me. It allowed me to hold pain differently, because what are books if not places for the past to live? And I needed to make a place for myself in grief. Grief totally snapped the narrative of my life. I got married. I am no longer a wife. I'm a narrative that makes no sense anymore. And for me, as someone who has writing, I needed to create a space where I could live. I had to rewrite a part of my story. And so Hereafter is a large part of that.
Did you know that writing was going to play that role for you? You were a writer beforehand, whether or not you wanted to admit it, because there's a part of the book where you have a hard time assuming that title. But did you know that writing was going to be this tool for you, or was it organically just the thing that you were drawn to?
Genuinely, I did not know. I remember when I was in school for writing, I had a few professors share with me that they said there will always be a moment when you know you're a writer, and there will be a moment when writing will save who you are. And I remembered thinking, that seems overly romantic. You know, like I just thought, that's very grand. But that is the truth, I think, when writing is what you have. So when my life fell apart, my health failed, Curtis died, I physically could not move. I really couldn't do anything at all. And there's nothing in the territory of grief that we can do. We have to speak with a new mouth. We have to learn a new language. And in that vast unknown that I was going to have to navigate without Curtis, I just reached for the thing that had always been there, which was my ability to write and to say in writing what things were like. And I was grateful that it was there. And it's true. In so many ways, writing, like the rubber ring, saved who I was in that moment.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Kusha Navidar, and we're joined by Amy Lin, who's a writer and teacher. Her book, Hereafter, a Memoir, discusses the loss of her late husband, Curtis, and what it means to go through grief when you lose a significant other. Amy, let's get to some listeners. On line one, we've got Pat in Manhattan. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? And hello, Amy. I'm so interested in seeking your book to read. I lost my husband after 39 years of marriage. He was 59, and he died suddenly, but horrifically, my daughter passed before him, 3 months before him. She was 29. So I think I was kind of in shock for about a year, but losing my daughter first and then my husband 3 months later, this is 10 years ago, has taught me an enormous amount about life and grief. So the three things I tell people that lose a loved one, whether it's mostly a husband, because I'm of an age where a lot of my girlfriends are losing their spouses, and I say, you're going to be tired. You're going to be tired all the time. And nothing will be the same. Nothing will be the same. And you have to re-look at your life now as a completely different storybook than what it was. You were defined by five people that went to three in a matter of 3 months, you know. And then the one thing that sticks with me, with my daughter, who was just brilliant through her illness, she said to me, Mommy, why are you crying? When you cry, you're really crying for yourself. You're sad because you're missing us. And don't cry. Don't cry, because I don't want you to cry. But, you know, they leave you with these poignant messages all the time. So, yes, but I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Pat, thank you so much for that call and for sharing your story and letting us benefit from it. And for, you know, we're so sorry for what you went through. Amy, how does it hear to feel that, the fatigue that Pat was describing?
Yeah, Pat, thank you so much for sharing that. One thing, hearing you, how much loss you hold, I just feel so deeply the land that you live in. And also so much, you say it's 10 years ago, how soon that is. How soon that feels to me. It feels so close to me, the loss of your beautiful daughter and husband, and it is exhausting. I'm really grateful that you share that with other people in your life, because often I think people don't understand that grief is work, that grievers are working so hard to understand this new and impossible reality, and that is so tiring for grievers. Thank you, Pat, for sharing that. I feel really honored to have heard about your daughter and husband.
We have Michael from Franklin. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I'm calling because, let me just preface what I'm going to say to you first, because I know how to get through grief. I was very blessed when I took my master's with a teacher who was trained basically in the Kubler-Ross school of teaching grief. And I was going through a difficult time because my mother passed at an early age. So I know how to do that. What I don't know how to do is right now, my wife of 44 years is dying. And I don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
44 years of absolute love beyond anything I could describe.
Yeah.
I just don't know how to do this.
I hear you.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing that for us. And we want you to stay on the line if you could. But Amy, I want to direct it towards you. You hear 44 years of marriage. When you are in community with people who are asking, how do I do this? I imagine there's no easy answer. How do you navigate that?
I really hear so keenly that you don't know how to do it. I must have said that a million times. I don't know how to do this. And especially, how do you do it without the beloved who you've always done things with? I really hear that. And it's so integral to our experience of grief. My only offering there is to not do it alone. And then I really believe that grief asks of us courage and tenderness and just process that none of us actually can do. We don't know how to do it, and that none of us can move into or through the world of grief alone, and that it is so important to tell people, I don't know how to do this. I am exhausted. I'm lost. I'm afraid. And to allow others to come alongside us and to help us, because this is not something that we know how to do, and we need others to help show us the way.
And Michael, I just want to thank you on behalf of all of us at All of It for sharing that story. We can hear the pain. Yeah. And like you said, Amy, sharing and grieving is an act of courage. And we want to thank you very much for sitting in this space with us. Let's go to another caller. We've also got Carol from New York. Hi, Carol.
Oh, hi. I just want to say I was listening to the program. Congratulations, Amy, on your book. And it was something that the author said that really struck me. I lost my husband almost 25 years ago. I was 34 years old. We were together 9 years, dated 4, married 5. And she said, the author said something about that time being compressed, it just kind of hit me, which was very odd because it's been so long. But it really was. We lived so much life in those short amount of years when we met and we dated. We worked together. We lived together. We moved a couple of times. We bought an apartment. We sold an apartment. We got married. We both excelled professionally. We traveled. We made tons of friends. And on top of all of that, we were navigating cancer for 5 of the 9 years we were together. And I think about that. It was like the most jam-packed decade of my entire life. And everything that usually happens over the course of a lifetime happened in those 2 short years. And nothing since has ever matched it. We lost friends, actually, right before my husband passed away. We lost a few family members. So it was extraordinary now to be 60 and looking back on it and to think of all that happened. And I know time is healing and time is all of that, and it is true. But it really, now I look back on it and I think it was an extraordinary important part of my life, even though it was only those 9 years.
Carol,
so thank you for letting me share that.
Carol, and thank you so much for calling. You talk about the passage of time, and that is a great jumping off point for a text that we just got with a question for you, Amy. From Michael, we have many thanks to Amy for giving voice to our shared pain, especially the loss of our identity that accompanied the sudden death. So Michael is 61, male, and he said that he's the loss of identity that accompanied the sudden death of his wife, who's 60 last year. For me, Michael writes, one unexpected challenge has been balancing my own need to find joy in the life and time left to me with the need of others, including our young adult children and our closest friends, to commiserate over our shared loss. How does Amy suggest signaling to those close to us that it's okay to experience joy and share it with us as we grieve? Amy.
Thank you. That's a beautiful question. What is so misunderstood, I think, sometimes about grief is that we tend to create grief as a binary against joy. We say you can either be grieving or you can be joyful, but we don't necessarily always hold that we are people of the both, that we contain multitudes. And there were moments, even hours or even days after Curtis died, where there were small moments of joy, where a friend gave me a hug and I relaxed into it. Our capacity as human beings is so much more complex than I think we allow when we make grief an opposite to joy. And I would communicate to the people around you that very fact, that we all hold all kinds of emotions and states of being all the time, and that it does not diminish the deep grief and the painful loss that you have had to experience joy, that rather we are all made fuller and more human when we acknowledge that our incredible grief absolutely lives in the same body that houses deep joy. And we do a greater credit to both pain and to both joy when we give them fullness in the same space.
And Carol, I want to say thank you again for sharing that. We had a lot of texts. In fact, Amy, we were planning on reading a passage of the book, but obviously the lovely swell of community that we've created has been so cherished as well. So callers, thank you for sitting in this space with us, and our best wishes to everyone. Amy, as you think about writing this book and being on the other side of it, what was the most unexpected or surprising aspect of writing this book for you, and what you'll carry with it in your own process?
I think one of the most surprising and beautiful things about this has been that this book came from a Substack, which is a newsletter that I still write called At the Bottom of Everything. And through that Substack, people still write to me. And I encourage anyone who did not get to share today to reach out to me. I would love to hear from you. But they share with me their pain, all kinds of pain, bodily pain, infertility, trauma. And they almost always say, by being able to read some of your loss and your pain, you gave me language and a tiny bit of courage to write to you about mine.
That was my conversation with author Amy Lynn about grieving the loss of her husband and how she faced the grief of being a young widow. Her experience is the subject of her new memoir. It's called Hereafter. Coming up next hour, we'll prepare for all that spring has to offer. I'm talking about tips for plant care, dealing with allergies, and what new books to look out for this season.